I am astonished to remember that the last time my guest sat in the studio was in 2004, so it's been 9 years. I did visit him more recently in his studio, in his office, the great Bibliotheca Alexandrina, the Alexandria Library in Egypt. A remarkable building, a bit Yawn Utsunish, right on the water, not far from what was, of course, the most famous library in history. Ismail Serageldin is the director of the library, but for a while there it was a close-run thing. First of all, let me remind you just what an immense operation it is. 4 museums, a planetarium, several academic research centres, 15 permanent exhibitions, 4 art galleries for temporary shows, a number of institutions, including the Middle Eastern and North African Network for Environmental Economics and the Arab Network for Women in Science Technology, and a conference centre for thousands of people. But Ismail's very success and the fact that Mrs. Mubarak was a great enthusiast for the library, in a sense, put both it and himself into peril. I was very concerned for the library and indeed for you, Ismail, but remind the listener how the people of Alexandria protected the library from what could have been destruction.
Well, thank you for mentioning that, because it really was an exalting moment. The young revolutionaries who, as the world has seen, in fact, by simply coming out in the tens of millions, brought down the Mubarak regime, and who burned down the headquarters of the party and some of the police stations and so on. When they came to the library, out of the crowd, the young people came out, held hands, created a human chain, and said, "This is the library. Nobody touches it." And not a stone was thrown at the library. And then they made a huge flag, 100 meters long, 10 meters wide, and wrapped it around the library. It was the most exalting moment in my life to see our work validated in this fashion, that regardless of political differences with the regime, they felt that the library was their space for freedom.
For a time there, you were in professional peril.
Well, yes, I mean, there were people who were attacking me, some who felt that I was the ancien regime, some who felt that they wouldn't mind having my job, some who felt that it was time that there was change, and some who disagreed with the liberal policies of the library. And all of these people, in various moments, there came a moment of real explosion back in October and 2011 and early January 2012. But what is beautiful about that is that it was contained by confronting anger with civility, passion with rationality, and not a blow was struck, not a person was wounded, not a stone was thrown.
Stones were thrown more recently, and blood was spilled.
Not really. The library was not a target. Yes,
but violence did hit the facade.
Yes, but violence did emerge. And in the streets, people turned from stones and sticks to bullets. And we were hit by a number of stray bullets, and a number of people were wounded who were protecting the library. But the library itself was not a target, although you can certainly be killed just as much by a stray bullet as by an intentional one.
I well recall that you were no enthusiast for the Muslim Brotherhood, and in fact, Morsi didn't like you.
Well, I think that's a bit unfair of on Morsi's side. Yes, I am no enthusiast for the Muslim Brotherhood, and I have not been an enthusiast for any zealot group or any extremist group. I have also taken always a view of a healthy skepticism about those who believe that they hold the truth whatever that is, ideologically or otherwise. And we are dedicated in the library to the multiplicity of views, the pluralism, the rationality, the debate. And whether it is extremists holding Mao's red book and chanting no other thing, or people from the Inquisition in the Middle Ages questioning Galileo, or more extreme varieties today, they are all the enemies of reason and of openness.
I should point out that Ismail is much more than the library director. He's had a very influential global role. You were for a while the director of the World Bank, weren't you?
So I was vice president of the World Bank for seven years.
I demoted you. I remember you speaking out and writing marvelously on environmental matters.
Yes, I was the first ever vice president for sustainable development at the bank, and it was my job to introduce environment into the World Bank's operation in a big way. And we did that to the point that Maurice Strong, who's pretty much the father of the modern environmental movement in many ways, who had been the Secretary General of Rio Earth Summit, 5 years later said, it's amazing that people who consider the World Bank part of the problem now consider it part of the solution.
Sorry, I pressed the wrong button there and turned myself off. Before we press on with Egypt, the whole world is, of course, mourning Mandela. How significant was he to the Egyptian people?
Mandela is a unique person. I've had the privilege of meeting him as soon as he came out of prison, and he attended his first heads of state meeting, and I was there in Addis Ababa. And I subsequently had the privilege of delivering the Mandela lecture in 2011. He is a person who inspires us by word and deed, who showed the world how they could rise above their highest expectations, and who has found his way into the hearts of so many in Egypt, in Africa, and around the world.
What can Egypt learn from South Africa?
Well, it learned easily. The biggest lesson that we need to learn is national reconciliation. Disagreements exist and abound, but I tell my compatriots that nowhere are disagreements as deep or as profound as they were in South Africa. And if Mandela was able to bring the country together, we should be able to find our way to reconciliation.
How optimistic are you, or are you optimistic about the future of your country?
I'm very optimistic about the future of my country in the middle term. I think we have never seen such an outpouring of public participation expressed in peaceful means. I mean, by and large, yes, there has been some violence, but given the scale of Egypt and what could have been, it has been somewhat contained. But more importantly, it is a country that is very much engaged with the idea of constitutional law, and where people would bring lawsuits against a sitting president. I mean, can you imagine that? Somebody bringing lawsuits against Bashar al-Assad and so on. But that's 3 to 5 years from now. For between now and 3 to 5 years, we have a very rocky and turbulent road.
Let's talk about books. At the end of last year, you gave the keynote at the first international summit of the book. Now, you and I once talked about what a clumsy way it was to try and read, if you had a scroll, versus the codex,
yes,
versus the bound book, which you could leaf through backwards and forwards so easily. You could cross-reference, you could index. But here we are looking at perhaps the death of the codex, and you don't seem particularly alarmed.
No, not at all. In fact, you just said it all. None of us are alarmed about the fact that we read Euripides and the great classics in codex form, although they were originally written on scrolls and read for centuries on scrolls. It was just more convenient. And if today it is more convenient to read it on an iPad or a Kindle or in some form other than the codex, so be it. What counts is really the book as a collection of words of a certain length, with that triple abstraction, the letter, the word, and the sentence. And with the combination that is done, where when I write and you read, or you write and I read, we construct the image together mentally.
One of the things you said is quite intriguing. E-books will replace the printed version of the book, and even those who claim the superiority of the printed version for bed, bath, or beach will be overcome by the ability to conjure up a virtual book that will float in the air before your eyes, where we will be able to turn the pages just by our thoughts.
Yes. Actually, the technology is already here. The technology of thought reading, where you read the electrical impulses of the brain, is being developed for paraplegics to be able to control robots without being able to speak or any such form. And that's advancing rapidly. Conjuring up a virtual screen in front of you has been done by Microsoft and by others. It already exists. And therefore, it's not a stretch to say that you could have a tiny little thing like a flash stick next to you, which you press on and out it comes. And then with your thoughts, you keep turning the pages or scrolling down, if you prefer scrolls, or sideways, or calling in images and videos. And these are different ways of seeing the same thing. But at the end of the
day... And the word itself, even the word, you think, is up for review.
Well, the word there, I am a little uneasy, but I still side in the end with those who trust the youth. I think youth right now is very much into texting, SMS, and things of that nature, emails, very short messages, very fast. It's very efficient. But I say to my friends, there's a difference between fast food and gourmet cuisine. Gourmet cuisine takes time to prepare and time to enjoy. And some of the subtleties of language require your appreciation, understanding of the hidden melodies that exist inside the phrases, the difference between blank verse and poetry and philosophical argument. All require words and the use of words and the combinations of words next to each other. And will they be able to enjoy it if they've gotten used to the fast food of just short messages? Well, I don't know, but I do know that they will find their own way and invent their own masterpieces, just as we did ourselves.
I find that for someone who's been through what you've been through recently, professionally and personally, I find this optimism quite extraordinary. Tell me about the library now. Are you struggling financially? Because Egypt's economy, of course, has not been advantaged by recent events.
Well, actually, yes, that's a very diplomatic way of putting it. It has not been advantaged. I think it has been somewhat disadvantaged, to say the least. But look,
I'm trying to learn your diplomatic
skills.
Yeah,
we're not suffering any more than anybody else is. Everywhere in the world, there are now budget cuts. There are budget cuts affecting the Library of Congress, affecting other libraries around the world. And I've been able, in fact, to do quite well for the library by a better management of our finances than most institutions. And when people say to me, what do you mean by that? I say, well, you remember, forget that I did a career at the World Bank advising governments when they got into trouble on their finances, on how they could manage to get out of it. So I should be able to do it for the library reasonably well. And recently, we have just gotten a huge gift, a second huge gift. I have managed to get 500,000 books from France a few years ago. And this year, just this last month, I've signed an agreement with the Netherlands for 450,000 books. And that's quite an achievement.
You were brought here tonight, and in fact I was brought to your office by Lorenzo Montesini, who's sitting on the other side of the glass. Lorenzo has devoted every waking hour to supporting the library for quite a long time. But there are Lorenzos all over the world, aren't there, that are devoted to the cause?
Yes, there are. And that is because the ancient Library of Alexandria was and probably still is the greatest adventure of the human intellect. It was the first time that ever that people thought in terms of universal knowledge and of bringing all the cultures of the world in one place and bringing all the great minds and from all the disciplines and allowing this flourishing of inquiry and expression and search and thinking. And it continues to inspire people long after it disappears. And therefore, recreating it represents a vote of confidence into the best of human nature.
Ismail, your technological exhilarations raises the possibility, of course, that one won't need an Alexandria library. It will become virtual. It will simply shimmer and exist in space.
Some of the collections in it will. And maybe there will be a day when we will interact with each other as effectively as you and I are looking at each other here virtually. But for the time being, I think we still need people. More importantly, we also need the role of libraries as mediators of not just of knowledge, because everything is available, but of helping you find your way in that enormous thicket of availability.
There was a time when almost the only light in Alexandria was the little white light of your office up the top of the library, where you were living as well as working in difficult times. I'm glad you survived. I'm glad the library survived. It's a great pleasure to see you again. Ismail Sirigeldin is director of the Great Alexandria Library in Egypt. And you'll be fascinated to know that our next story tells the history of Baghdad in poetry. Exactly.
Bravo.
The sort of thing you like.
Indeed, bravo.
coming up on LNL, yes, Baghdad in poetry.